It's the Famous Monsters Podcast, the official podcast of Famous Monsters of Filmland Magazine.
Welcome to the Famous Monsters Podcast, the official podcast of Forrest J. Ackerman's classic magazine that started it all back in 1958, often imitated, never duplicated. We're more than just monsters. We cover sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and all kinds of genre pop culture, living up to Forrest's classic roots while staying current and ahead of the curve. I'm David Weiner, editor of Famous Monsters, and with me today is Famous Monsters media and promotions guru, Caroline Stevenson.
Hello, hello.
All-around jack-of-all-trades and resident artist George Marrero is with us.
Hello, hello.
And producing the podcast today, as always, is FM's Cameron Hathaway.
I'm wearing my Famous Monsters t-shirt this time, just putting it out there.
Yeah, because last time, I don't know what you were thinking. The brand new issue of Famous Monsters magazine is out now. It's a sci-fi themed issue and Star Wars spectacular. Woo! Featuring, yeah, it's got a lot of really fun stuff. And, of course, I think the big thing on this issue, other than Mark Hamill, and our exclusive interview with him, is our variant cover, which is Flash Gordon.
Aww.
He'll save every one of us at this table. And it's our variant cover. We did three variant covers, and it's our subscriber cover. So if you're looking for the Flash Gordon cover by Terry Wolfinger, which is amazing, you're not going to find it on newsstands. You're only going to find it where, Caroline?
At CaptainCo.com.
Yes, or you could just go to FamousMonsters.com to get to Captain Co. to subscribe and to get individual issues. But if you really want to find our Flash Gordon issue, that's the way to go, because if you're standing at Barnes & Noble, you're not going to find it.
None for you.
By the way, if you are at Barnes & Noble and you can't see Famous Monsters, go to the top of that rack, look in the back, take that Famous Monsters and put it in the front for all to see. That's what I do every single time.
In front of Fangoria and Rumorg.
Yes, exactly. And you put the Fangoria and Rumorg in the back. No. With all due respect, those are awesome magazines as well. You know, just always thinking about us. So on today's podcast, if you haven't figured out already, we're going to dive into the magazine, and we're going to dive into two main topics that we cover in the magazine. Flash Gordon and Space 1999. Both are celebrating anniversaries. The 35th anniversary for Flash Gordon is in early December, just passed. And Space 1999, which came out in September of 75, has got its 40th anniversary. So for this issue, I had the honor of interviewing Sam J. Jones, Flash Gordon himself. And I also had the honor of interviewing Moonbase Alpha's Commander Koenig, Oscar winner Martin Landau, which was quite the experience. Those are wonderful interviews that I had. And for you, our dear listener, we're going to be playing some exclusive and wonderful excerpts from those interviews. Well, today also, because it's a Flash Gordon day, we have a very, very, very special guest with us in the studio. His name is Jason Lindsay, and he's the Biff Bang Pow co-founder, and he's an all-around Flash Gordon savior.
I'll take Gordian. Yeah. That's fine. I can work with that. Yeah.
I feels think right. We can call you a Gordian.
Kind of
I think that's like a
tongue.
Is it like a Whovian or like a Trekkie or Trekker?
Now, we got to make sure that people aren't confused with the Gordian Knot fans and then the Flash Gordon fans.
Yeah, I know that a lot of the audience is Gordian Knot people, so just, and nothing against them, but today's not about you guys. So, yeah, we're gonna get right to the other thing.
Okay. When you look at the new issue of Famous Monsters, you'll see Jason and his good friend, iconic comic book artist Alex Ross. I had a wonderful conversation with you, Jason.
You did,
and Alex.
Yes, you did.
It lasted about 2 hours on the phone. He was in Chicago. You were out here,
yes.
And I pretty much was a bystander trying to get a word in edgewise between you two because you're such huge fans.
Well, and it was spirited. I think, can you use the word spirited, that conversation?
Yeah.
That was a saucy conversation.
That did get saucy.
There was a lot of heavy stuff in
there. You're not kidding.
And just to add side note, when you do look at the magazine and you look at the pictures of me and Alex, I'm the guy on the left. You know, the 7 foot comic book artist guy, the bald, talented guy, that's Alex Ross. You can't miss me. I'm the guy on the left. You go, who the hell snuck into the picture?
You're the good looking one, right?
Yes, but I am stunningly handsome. And it nearly broke the printer, I think.
Almost blinding.
Didn't you guys have problems printing that issue?
Because, I did. My eyes. Yeah,
people were falling over. Yeah.
I really can't wait to get Alex's reaction to this podcast. Well, you and Alex talk about some of your favorite things about Flash Gordon and your inspirations, and a lot of it is themed the way I whittled down a two-hour conversation that couldn't quite transcript-wise fit in our magazine without having a 150-page special issue.
But you can order it now for $79.95 on the FM website. No, sorry, go ahead.
I basically cut this thing down to kind of be not only your excitement about the movie, but the shadow of Star Wars and how this coming out in 1980, it really affected people's perceptions coming out of Empire Strikes Back. And you kind of have a personal story about that because you saw Empire and that kind of changed your life. Maybe a little differently than other people.
Well, let me just jump in. Well, first of all, hi, everyone. It's great to be here. This is really, really something.
Welcome.
I mean, I'm not – this is amazing to be at the Famous Monsters offices with a bunch of cool people that are all like monster people and sci-fi freaky deaky people flying their flags. And it's like every room I've gone into already, there's just all these great paintings to photograph and loads of liquor to drink in their desks. But thank you so much for inviting me, for having me here. And I thought I could just kick this off real quick. Why don't I – it's like a two-minute little intro that I did. Mm-hmm. To the film at BAFTA this past weekend when I was in London for the 35th anniversary. And if you'd like, I can answer that question by way of the intro. Because no one's heard it unless you're in the theater.
By all means. All right. Please go ahead.
Here we go. Can I get some mood lighting, please?
And while you're thinking about that real quick, and I'm sorry, I'm just going to give a little context really quick.
Please.
Flash Gordon celebrated his 35th anniversary with a spectacular one-off reunion screening with a bunch of these folks, and we'll talk about who arrived at this place and who was there and who walked the red carpet and why it was all put together. But let's hear your introduction.
Okay, so I'm going to need a little help from the room here, as if you're the audience and you maybe do a little golf clap at the proper. Okay, ready?
Nice. Like this?
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Good evening and welcome to the 35th anniversary celebration of Flash Gordon at BAFTA. Let me just say that one more time. Welcome to the 35th anniversary celebration of Flash Gordon at BAFTA. Okay, now calm down. It's hard to believe that not only has it been that long since the film premiered, but that it's taken this long for the rest of the world to catch up with it. I think I can safely say that a good portion of the audience here tonight are probably children of the 70s. Not you. Not you.
Not me.
Never mind.
Not
me. Good thing you weren't there. And like me, your lives were changed by a movie called Star Wars. It arrived in 1977, and the years between its release and its first sequel, I ate, slept, and drank everything involved with the film and tried to get my sci-fi fix anywhere I could. While waiting for the next installment of the Star Wars saga, I came across an animated series on Saturday mornings called Flash Gordon, The Greatest Adventure of All, in 1979. I was glued to those adventures on Mongo week in and week out. Around the same time, one of my favorite bands, Queen, released an album called The Game, and it wore out the speaker on my portable cassette player.
That's an MP3 player for you folks.
Yeah, before MP3.
What?
Before the internet.
Before MP3?
He had an iPod. Remember the iPod that John Cusack had during Say Anything? Oh, that he held over his head?
Oh.
Let me I'll tell you about my Big Spiderbeck collection, my 78 jazz records. Then the moment we were waiting for finally came, and The Empire Strikes Back arrived in May of 1980. And coming out of the theater, I immediately went into a massive depression. For those of you who don't know, spoilers, terrible things happened to my hero, Han Solo. To this day, my mother swears if she ever meets George Lucas, she'll tell him what an awful funk that 10-year-old went through because of that damn film. And then one day, several months later, sitting in a darkened theater, I saw a trailer for Flash Gordon. I sat there slack-jawed wondering, how was this possible? Flash and Ming and music by Queen? I'm not positive, but I might have passed out, only to be revived by a slap from my older brother and a swig of soda. I raced to see it as soon as it came out, and 2 hours later was lifted out of my depression. Flash Gordon didn't look, sound, or feel like anything I'd ever seen before or since. It is a one-off, a unique and beautiful thing. The confluence of events that came together to not only make it, but to assemble an amazing international cast, brilliant set and costume designers, remarkable FX team, a fantastic musical score, a director working at the height of his powers, and arguably the biggest band on the planet at the time, make it more than special. Quick side note, the song The Hero in the end credits is one of the greatest Queen tracks of all time, so stay in your freaking seats. I ask you to pay close attention to all the things I just mentioned tonight in big screen glory and remind yourselves of all the genre motion pictures that we've seen since that don't have an ounce of the style or creativity or wit of what you're watching. Now, to be fair, it is not Star Wars, and it is not to all tastes, but I don't want it to be. It's special. It is a secret handshake. It is a wink of acknowledgement between people, and it has been for me for a very long time. There's nothing like it, and probably never will be. So, whether it's your first time or your 50th, ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for the majesty, the grandeur, and the spectacle that is the greatest adventure of all, Flash Gordon.
Oh, wow.
Woo!
Feel the claps.
And then, like, that's the point that people were crying. Ladies were throwing undergarments at me. You know, security had to get me out of there. And, you know, it nearly just ruined the whole thing.
We have to stop and watch Flash Gordon now.
Right? Should we?
All right. Yeah.
We should just
take a break.
Just pause.
Hey, you know, here's a taste of the trailer just to get people in the mood.
Remove the Earth Woman. Prepare her for our pleasure. Flash.
It sounds like an amazing experience there.
It's beyond words, really.
For me, Flash Gordon was, it was kind of interesting for me. It's literally the first movie screening I ever went to.
Oh.
My dad knew someone who knew someone in New York.
Okay.
When I grew up in New York. And
okay.
I was but a lad of 12 years old.
Nice.
And my dad said, do you want to see a movie?
Mm.
And I said, okay. And he said, well, this is a special movie. We're going to go into the city. And it's on a Saturday, and you got to put on your good shoes. And I was like,
wow,
that meant like a serious business.
To put on your Clarks.
And I remember it was a super rainy day, and I remember he said, we're going to see Flash Gordon. And I had no idea what he was talking about. I really did not know anything.
Now, were you sort of clued into the sci-fi thing at that age?
Hugely.
Okay, but you hadn't been familiar with the character yet.
Well,
okay.
I when I think back of it, I watched that animated series. But yes. The animated series was all in 1979, correct?
The first season was 1979, Filmation. It is, if anyone out there hasn't seen it and wants to track it down, it is one of the greatest animated series of all time. Right up there with Johnny Quest and the Batman animated stuff.
Oh, it's
there
good stuff.
Johnny Quest.
You got that reference.
Johnny.
I did.
Thank you.
Thank you. But let me tell you about Fatty Arbuckle. No, I'm kidding. That's too far back. Is it too soon to talk about Fatty Arbuckle? Sorry. It is amazing. And what's amazing, beyond the rotoscoping, the animation, the voice cast, they shot models. They filmed models like Battlestar Galactica, Star Wars, Dykstra kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then they rotoscoped over the models, which had never been really done before. And it's incredible. They shot it like in a black light kind of thing. The thing that it really, I think it holds up. Well, there's another backstory I can tell quickly about Filmation and the film, but it's divided into chapters, and that became Filmation's and Lou Scheimer's kind of undoing, because the networks were going, well, we go to repeat this, if it's out of order, you know, kids are going to be confused.
But yeah, no one did sequential television at that point. It was all episodic.
Exactly.
No one knew what to do.
And every, you know, chapter five, you know, and that's how it was. So when it came back for the second season, it was very much revamped and not what it was.
Yeah,
and in a 22-minute thing, there's two like 11-minute stories.
Shorts.
And then they did the cardinal sin that everyone knows. They brought in a Scrappy Doo.
Oh,
there's
a little
pink dragon called Gremlin that just, even as a kid, I was going, what? And I'm giving them, and by the way, listeners, I'm giving the middle finger right now, if you don't know what that is. Because it ruined the whole thing. But that first season, so you really have to, you know, quantify that. It's, that's it. And what happened was, just a quick thing, because I told Mike Hodges this, the director of Flash Gordon, and he didn't know this, was that at the time, Dino De Laurentiis, okay, the backstory always, everybody kind of knows, Lucas wanted to make Flash Gordon after Graffiti.
Could not get the rights
through King Features. They wanted too much or whatever it was. People think Dino De Laurentiis had the rights back then. He did not. Filmation got them to do the animated series. Dino meets, Lou Scheimer at a party, says, "Hey, Lou, how you doing?" No, whatever. And, but he says, if you can get me, cause he's talking, Scheimer wants to do this 2-hour thing on the networks at night for the pilot. And he's running out of money. And Dino says, "I will help finance the rest of this if you can get me the live action rights." Mm. And that's how it happened to do the motion picture. So if you, there's a lot of overlap in the design, even in the filmation thing that went into, you know, Danilo Donati and all the crew on the film that kind of came from the animated thing as well. And it's nobody really kind of knows that, but it's, little tidbit for
tying in the well, I loved all those Filmation animated Saturday morning cartoons.
Star Trek was a great one. Yeah.
But I remember I had seen a couple, not enough to really get Flash Gordon yet. And I remember that rainy day. I walk in my good shoes, which were now not so good because I stepped in a bunch of puddles. And I knew I had to be on my best behavior. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first thing I smelled was popcorn. Ooh. This is the first time I ever got free popcorn at a movie. There was a popcorn cart.
Ooh.
And I already knew that this was a special.
I was going to say, that's a good sign. You walk in and you got popcorn, free popcorn. Yeah.
I sat down and I remember the movie started and I remember my first thought was, this isn't Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of old timey cartoon images.
Yeah, the credits, the opening credits. Yeah.
And I remember thinking to myself, I'm not going to like this at all.
Right.
This is not for me.
Right.
Where is my Star Destroyer?
Right. It's not updated.
And then I was transformed like many others who saw this and I loved it.
You dug it as a kid.
Oh, absolutely. And I got to tell you, I think the Queen music is what ushers you in and really gets.
Yeah, it's
truly excited.
I said that to someone on the night. I would still have loved this thing, but because I love Queen so much, it is synonymous with Queen. I can't hear or see one without the other, you know, thinking of that combo. And they're just connected. I mean, even when I hear other Queen albums or songs, I go back to Flash Gordon somewhere in the back of my brain. And it really was that mind-blowing moment sitting in a theater watching a trailer as a kid and hearing this voice and going, this doesn't seem... Because as a kid, you know, I didn't have like a Wikipedia to look this up. And then the credits, oh, that's a
Wikipedia.
Sorry. I'm so sorry. We had an abacus that we bills with. But there's a title thing at the end, Music by Queen. And it just hit me in the chest.
Tingles.
And it still does. And by the way, just a real quick side note, the Filmation thing got an amazing range of action figures by Mattel at the time, which was not an everyday thing for a weekly animated series to get a merchandise line. And it's gorgeous stuff. The packaging is amazing, but the film never got anything. I mean, it didn't, it was so effed really when it came out, and Hodges talked about it. And well, one of the theories, the reason they don't think it did well was because of Sam, not because of his performance, because of what happened between him and Dino and essentially getting let go from the film. And when that happened, when he wasn't doing junkets or press or talk shows, there's nothing out there. Mm-hmm. There's like something from Australia at the time. They focused instead on Ming. The campaign became Ming.
Right.
The AMSL poster, etc. And it wasn't the way they thought it should have been marketed or sold. Keep in mind, it did very well in Europe and Japan. I mean, it did very well around the world. In the UK, it is a household name, you know, really is something. It just never really was big here, but it did well. It was not a disaster by any means.
Well, we're definitely going to talk about the action figures and the toys, but I want to talk about what you guys thought when, what did you guys think when you first saw this movie? I mean, were you coming, your perspective is probably a little different, Caroline and George and Cameron, because you guys saw this probably not in the theater. So how did Flash Gordon come your way, and what was your perception? Is that a good word?
Keep in mind that David and I were in The Little Rascals, so we
Spanky.
Were you Buckwheat?
Spanky? Keep it down.
No, I was I was stymie, actually. Yeah,
I could see that.
Well, I was actually introduced to the original, the 50s Flash Gordon, by my stepdad. So I, you know, we've got the first set season with Buster Crab.
Oh, that's awesome.
Very watched cool. a couple of the episodes, and they're, I mean, I really enjoyed them. They're just fun and campy and cartoony, but, you know, seeing the 80s movie was, it was a different experience. And
first of all, it was in color, right?
Well, yes. Woo, color. Yeah, that black and white stuff is weird.
Am I allowed to jump in real quick
there?
So what was your exposure to it before you actually sat and watched it? Like, were you familiar with it at all? Like, was it through Ted or like other people, or like, when did it first kind of come onto your radar?
I mean, it would have been, trying to think what all came first.
Was it the comic strip at all?
Was it a TV experience? Was it someone said, you got to watch this?
I think it was after we watched the black and white version that I think my sister got my stepdad the 80s movie for Christmas. And we watched it one time. And I thought it was absolutely spectacular because I love films that are really, you know, when films come from a comic, like, part of me wants to see that really comic-y, like, the bright colors and the outlandish costumes. And that's what it did.
Oh, it ticks
and
all those boxes.
It was...
And if
I can ask real quick, though, did your stepdad like it? Because he loved the original, and he introduced you to the original. Mm-hmm. So what was his take on it?
For him, it was definitely a little bit different. obviously, if you compare them side by side, but he enjoyed it.
Different in that he kept on pausing when Ornella Muti was on Princess Or.
Oh, Ornella.
No.
Ornella, maybe. Will we ever get it's over
possible.
You?
No. Anyway, continue.
He enjoyed it a lot, though. It was, obviously, like I said, it was a little bit different from a lot different from the 50s version, but it was fun. It was just a lot of fun to watch for everyone.
George, what was your take on it?
I watched it in the 80s, probably around 88-ish. So I was about 5 years old.
I remember 88.
It was a good year.
Good year. Damn good year.
So tell me about it.
As a child, I remember it being super vibrant and fun at the time. Watching it again as an adult recently, there were things I hadn't noticed as a kid. Like, you compare this to Star Wars. Star Wars, great adventure and everything, but this was a very sexy film. Like, this thing was...
Thank you.
Wait, were you watching Flesh Gordon or Flash Gordon?
Oh, wait, what?
I promise you won't get those mixed up because Flesh Gordon is not sexy at all. Flash Gordon is sexier than that.
Like, in the scenes where there was something violent happening, there's very sexual undertones, you know?
It's a very... There's like an S&M kind of...
Yeah.
I mean, one of the first things that Dalton says... You know,
Timothy Dalton.
I'm sorry.
Prince Baron.
I know him as Dalton. We're pals.
Yeah.
We're all pals.
Timothy Dalton, when everyone's seen the film, right? When Aura shows up in Arboria with Flash, he says, I knew you were up to something. I confess I didn't think it was necrophilia.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, this was ostensibly going to be a kid's thing. There's a lot of kids goofy stuff in there too. I'm sure they at one point thought they could do Happy Meals and toys must have been discussed or whatever. There's some heavy and like the
first thing I did when I walked out of that screening, I said, Dad, what's necrophilia?
And then we went to the morgue. No, sorry.
Even a good minute or two before he talks to her, they're having that ceremony.
Oh,
you know, the initiation for the young man who's about to become a man.
And she's
you just
like,
you hear the sounds of.
And she's digging it. She's like watching it.
What's going on? And that look on her, she is tantalized.
Do you remember when they kiss on Mongo? And she's like, I'll see you soon. He's like, lying bitch. like, and I'm a kid going, ooh, that was, I mean, James Bond never said that. And he wasn't Bond at that, but I mean, saying Roger Moore never, Connery never said that. You know, like that was pretty heavy stuff for kids to kind of, so it is it's a weird mix, but I'd love to hear what you thought as well, Cameron. Cause...
Oh, well, I got a bombshell for this podcast. Before last night, I had never seen Flash Gordon.
Wow.
And honestly,
get your things and get out.
Thank you, everybody. I'm out of here. No, honestly, I was like so ashamed after watching it because like, I grew up in a Star Wars household. Like my mom's a sci-fi person. She introduced me to all sci-fi fantasy. Mm-hmm. And so it was just Star Wars, but I don't know why it took so long to watch this movie, but it was like so fantastic.
Oh, that's great.
Like, I was always familiar with the soundtrack.
You know what? It's okay.
It's okay. It's okay. I feel like I'm in a safe space.
It's
right
okay.
Now,
you,
I can
you,
open
you know
up.
What? You made it.
Yeah,
you made
I
it
did.
Here.
You're among the only group that will accept you.
And for those of you out there, Cameron is a good example. It's never too late.
It's never too late.
It's still out there for you guys.
So what's
right?
better?
So did you, what was your, I mean, what was your reference for it before? Cause you sound like it's most fresh. What was the reference for you before seeing it?
Obviously Queen's, take on it. And then the King Syndicate, I did grow up in households and like I did have family who would collect comic strips or the Sunday funnies and stuff like that. So I do remember vaguely like being introduced to that character and like, oh, okay, so this is cool. Some sci-fi little thing. It's not Commander Cody, but you know, it's something in its own right.
Right.
But then like just last night, I was like, all right, I got to do my homework. Got to watch this movie. Mm-hmm. And it just blew my mind. Like, I was just so upset because I'm going to go home and like watch it 50 more times on this podcast.
That's awesome.
It was amazing to me.
That's
it was
awesome.
Like my movie of the year. Is it too, like to say that in 2015?
I don't think so.
Movie of the year.
It's all about how you watch it.
It never got acknowledged at the time. But you know, can I just add to this? Cause that's really cool. This is kind of like the Comic-Con thing I told you about. Mm-hmm. All the, and I'm joking, but we're not ancient. David and I aren't like, granddads.
Wait,
but like
don't trip over my walker.
But you know what I'm saying? Like the young people, the young females that were coming up to me at the booth, you know, at Comic-Con.
This is a Comic-Con when you were debuting your Biff Bang Pal and Entertainment Earth action figures that are 3 3/4 action figures.
Just this past summer.
Get to in a moment. But yeah.
And it was just so refreshing all the things that they were into and everything else and how they're sort of going from one thing to the next and experiencing things, whatever. And I love it. To me, it's like, it doesn't look or feel like anything else. It's not for everyone. But I use it in the same way. How would you describe Queen? I mean, if no one had ever heard Queen and never heard their stuff, how would you describe that band? Would you go,
it's like Muse, but they did it first.
Oh, how dare you? No, but I'm saying they were such a mishmash
that for so many reasons
shouldn't have worked. And they were so audacious in so many ways. And that to me is what the film is. You don't smirk when you hear that music. Inside you kind of smirk, but they're deadly serious. Queen, they can turn it up to 11, whether it's kind of goofy or not, but they mean it. And very few things, I always say this about that I love. Sorry.
No one's ever heard that word. It's just not printed in Famous Monsters.
Sorry, kids.
That's okay.
Sorry, children. If you mean it, nobody means it. Do you know what I mean? Like everything is so fickle and just, oh, they're not into that. And I've got a niece that's already over One Direction. Oh, that last album was terrible. Like, shit. Okay. What are you into now? You know, but I mean, if you mean it, if you've got a passion, then you're halfway there. And this thing, it means it. It shouldn't have worked, but it does somehow. And like I say, it's that secret handshake.
Well, the people who mean it, put together this wonderful thing at BAFTA. And I just want to just talk very briefly about that. Not too briefly.
Sure.
But given our time.
Yeah. Sorry.
Who was there? And you also told me before we got on this podcast
that
a certain individual wanted to make sure that you were the master of ceremonies doing the Q&A. Who was there?
Okay. Well, in the cast, Sam Jones, Flash Gordon, Melody Anderson, Dale, Brian Blessed, played Voltan, Mike Hodges, who directed, Trevor Butterfield, who was one of the Hawkmen, Howard Blake, who did the musical score, and I've got a Freddie story that I can tell, which is Freddie Mercury couldn't be there, obviously, and he told me this Freddie story that just hit me in the feelies. Peter Wingard. Mm. One of my highlights was sitting next to Peter Wingard for 15 minutes talking about clothing. Mm. He looked at me. The first thing he said to me was, he's 95, by the way. And he said, oh, I love your suit. He said, I was going to wear something like that, but I thought is this all right? He's in a pinstripe suit, polka dot shirt, polka dot scarf, overcoat, black fedora, and beetle boots. And I said, Peter, you're still outdressing the whole room. You're fine. You know,
and then you changed your suit from polka dots to something else.
I know. I thought, shit, he outdressed me once again. But that was an amazing experience,
just having him there. Who's the gent that brought you over the pond to do this in the first place? Obviously, we know that you love Flash Gordon. We know that you were in Famous Monsters, but I don't think that got you the job.
Oh, I'd like to say that it did, but no, it's this cosmic, you know, weird stuff that was happening ever since Comic-Con, the way things would sort of line up. And my wife and I were already planning a trip over. Mm. We've been over 6 or 7 times. We have friends over there. It's like our second home kind of thing. And we'd been there for Thanksgiving a few years ago, and we had already been planning this. at Comic-Con, Sam Jones was at the booth. I was never supposed to be there on Sunday. And he and I are sitting and we're talking. And he sets up a camera and interviews me out of nowhere. Hey, tell me why this thing means so much to you. Like, really? Right now? And so he filmed it for 7 minutes. It made it to a woman named Lisa Downs in the UK who's doing a documentary called Life After Flash.
Yep.
About Sam and the film and everything. Long story short, we get communicating, and within a couple of weeks, she says, well, when are you going to be over in November? I said, well, we'll be from here to here. Because we're planning a thing at BAFTA right now by the 28th. So what I'm getting to is she put the invite out to moderate. On the night, I see Sam, I see Melody. Melody, oh, Jason, I can't believe you're here. Sam's like, hey, buddy, how you doing? He does. And to suddenly there's a woman, this beautiful woman standing right here, and beautiful, and she says, Jason. And I realize, oh, that's Sam's wife. I saw her at Comic-Con and she's talking to me. And we make our way up into the thing and we're at the reception and just very, because now I'm on autopilot. Very offhand, she says, I'm so glad you could do this because Sam said, you got to get Jason, and I'm so glad. And I said, sorry. Say that one more time.
Oh.
And she said that a couple of names had sort of been tossed around and that Sam said, no, you got to get Jason's the guy. He knows more about this than anybody. So we were already going to be in town, and it just worked out that the night before we were going to leave was the BAFTA thing, and for the past 3 months, it's sort of been, you know, planned around that.
You know, Seth MacFarlane called me this morning, and he said he's still pissed.
You know what? You can't imagine how many times I said, he's got to be there. Mm-hmm. I mean, couldn't Seth, like, just grab the Concorde, if it still existed, and just walk
since
over
it doesn't
backwards.
Fly anymore, yeah. He will bring
he'd
it
rebuild
out
it,
the...
send a rocket over, and get back for lunch for dinner for us. So that didn't happen. But lots of cool people. And Matt Berry, did anybody know that the Mighty Boosh or the IT crowd?
Yes.
All right. So Rich Fulcher's a good friend of mine, and Matt Berry was in a thing called Snuffbox with him and the Boosh.
Yeah.
He's got a big show right now called Toast of London, which hasn't aired here yet. Mm-hmm. And he and I were talking at the Groucho Club a couple of nights before, and suddenly I mentioned Flash Gordon. He's like, Flash Gordon? Wait. What do you mean? This weekend? Like, yeah. Invite him. He was like a kid in a candy store. He's like, I had the stickers. You know, I mean, he showed up and it was just, he just had the best time.
And so lastly, on this BAFTA event, since you had so many people on stage, how was wrangling all these wonderful personalities? And did Brian Blessed deliver a baby?
You know what? He didn't deliver a baby that night.
A little context because everyone's looking at us funny. Do you want to tell?
Like about a month earlier, he was doing an interview on, I think, like Radio 4 or something, BBC Radio or something. And you sent me the clip, I think.
Yeah, I think I did.
He tells a story about Voltan, Brian Blessed. I mean, he is – not only is he larger than
Gordon's
life.
Gordon's alive.
But
alive.
But now – and that's a thing that he can't walk down the street without somebody in London going, hey, say the thing. But he is now this personality on talk shows that turns it up. So here's Blessed. He turns the needle up to here. And he was on this radio thing and just offhanded talking about how he was walking past a Hyde Park in the 60s and some woman was, you know, in labor. And he jumped over his fence and delivered the baby. And then but the payoff was, and then I just bit the cord with my mouth. And he just bit the cord in half. So to answer your question, you know,
with
at that
teeth.
Point, you've got you know, behind the scenes people, you got Mike Hodges. And I got to be in the green room for a bit as well. And you, as you know, you can suss out very quickly, you know, no offense to anyone, but if I ask this guy how to make, you know, what time it is, he'll tell you how to make a watch in like 10 minutes. And so you got to go, I'm going to stay away from him and go to him. Mm-hmm. So that started to happen. I knew that it would be organic once we got on stage, but Blessed is the Tasmanian devil. I mean, he is. So you know what you're going to get from Sam. You know what Melody might, she's very, Hodges might ramble a bit. You know, Wingard was, sorry? What? You know, because it was 95 and I had to go, does anybody ask you to say lines from the, I've never lied. No, lines from the, and then Blessed was just, and within the first 4 minutes, every orifice was discussed, every sexual thing you imagine. And then it's like, and Deep Roy, when he says, you know, I'm not very small. I mean, I'm quite, well, I thought, well, I'm like, Brian, great, moving on. So I kind of, and loads of people came up to me afterwards and said, I don't know how you wrangled Brian Blessed, you know, but it was just, you know, it was larger than life, the whole thing, really.
Well, we're going to go take a quick break right now.
Thank God.
When we come back from our little break, we're going to hear from Sam Jones himself sharing behind-the-scenes tales of Flash Gordon.
Is he here?
He's under the table.
Oh, we keep him locked.
I had a wonderful, wonderful conversation with him, and we're going to play an excerpt from that. And what he thinks of this film 35 years later. So
Very
let's
cool.
take a quick break.
This holiday season, cozy up by the fireplace with a mug of hot chocolate with extra marshmallows and enjoy your ugly Famous Monsters Christmas sweater with a loved one. With the Famous Monsters Holiday Package, you'll receive an ugly Christmas sweater, two coasters, and a current issue of the magazine, all for $49.99. A deal so good, it makes St. Nicholas oh so jolly. Available only at CaptainCo.com. And while you're there, don't forget to order your Shock Box for the month of December. Every Shock Box is guaranteed an exclusive Famous Monsters t-shirt featuring an older magazine cover, a special comic from American Gothic Press, a priceless matted print, and oh so much more. A $70 value available to you for only $19.99. Be the coolest monster kid on your block and order yours today.
We're back. We're back. And we're back. There you go. That's a fun commercial. So I want to just say that my retrospect feature in the current issue of Famous Monsters on stands, on newsstands now. I can't speak today. I spoke with Sam Jones. It was a really wonderful conversation. He still loves talking about this movie 35 years later. During our conversation, I touch on what he's been up to since not only Flash Gordon, but taking a break from the entertainment industry in general. And we also talk about his career resurgence thanks to this gentleman named Seth MacFarlane and Ted and Ted 2. Did you guys see Ted 2? Did you guys see these?
Ted, yes. I saw Ted, first one.
He really kills it in that.
It was great.
I just want to add, I literally sat in the theater going, I cannot believe someone else loves this thing as much as I do. And now is in a position to do what he's doing for it. I can't. If he's listening, Seth, I'd love to meet you someday. I cannot thank you enough for how you've embraced that film and introduced it.
You are his thunder buddy, aren't you?
Absolutely. Take that any way you like, Seth.
In the theater, I remember when I saw him pop up as Sam Jones, and I saw them together doing the Flash scene. I was like, yes!
And then when you saw Sam Jones doing, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe what he's doing.
Speaking of the rocket cycle thing, and in Ted, I actually got wind of Sam. No, I'm sorry, of something to do with Flash Gordon much earlier than the film came out. Guy in, you know, it's the community of like fan for this movie, it's kind of small. And this guy in the UK somehow got a hold of me through someone else about making a custom rocket sled for the 7-inch figures that Biff Bang Pow did.
Okay.
For Sam, for the Flash Gordon figure. And he said something in passing about the rocket sled full size being made for a Mark Wahlberg film. And I just thought, you must be getting this wrong somewhere. And then sat in the theater and
what
saw Ted,
world?
And that's what. That was the punchline, basically.
Well, going to our conversation, Sam and Melody Anderson were, it turns out they were the only Americans, it seems, on the set, at the Flash Gordon set, practically, which was a mixture of Brits and Italians.
It was a festival of nations. And but I think Lorenzo might have been on, I think he was on, Lorenzo Semple Jr. was the screenwriter.
Right.
I believe he was on set, but that was it. It was the three of them.
But they were very much outnumbered.
And Melody was very close with Timothy Dalton, by the way. It turns out. No, I mean, nothing ever. No. She said flat out, no hanky-panky. But she was so lonely over there in London. He every Sunday would have her over and make her brunch.
Oh, that's
And the
cool.
first time they ever saw the film was together. And she said, and no hanky-panky. She goes, much to my regret, he never tried a thing with me.
What a gentleman.
I miss those days when... Well,
right? That's what she's saying.
I miss those days when Timothy Dalton was making me eggs and toast for breakfast.
Right?
I really do. Well, there was like a serious language barrier in that movie because they would have to practically do sign language sometimes because the producer Dino De Laurentiis, who was Italian, and you did a wonderful impression of him.
Everybody did. Everybody did the same impression, which was very broken and very. How many films you make? I've made three. I made a 300. No matter what it was, he'd say, I made 300 to everybody. There is something very old school about that European thing where it's like, if you get slighted, they will never forget it. Mm. And he was that kind of person. And that's what happened with the Sam thing.
Well, there were all sorts of other challenges in making that movie. It seems like it was kind of a straightforward affair. And I asked Sam about some of those challenges working on the film. And here is his unexpected answer.
Other than the language barrier, what would you say was one of the biggest challenges in making the film? Like a particular set piece or costume or prop or just overall choreography?
Well, production-wise, everything was so visually so beautiful with the reds and the golds and the silvers. Well, you know, a lot of that was paint. Well, it was paint, other than the costumes. That was hand beading. But the floors and the walls were fresh paint. Well, whatever, painted, you know, days, weeks earlier. But mm-hmm. still, every time if I'm wearing a white shirt, a T-shirt that says Flash, and I'm rolling around on the floor or on the rotating disc, well, we're talking about, okay, now my shirt has silver paint on it. Now it's got red paint on it, you know. So, yeah, it can be problematic. So the challenges were okay. Just, of course, we're getting dirty and sweaty anyway from a fight scene. So, you know, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, it was, you know, David, when you're young and, I mean, you're 25 and you're, you know, you're athletic anyway, and you just don't, I remember, I guess in particular, the rope. I had to climb the rope over and over and over again. I don't care if you're a professional rope climber. You know, after the 15th time, there's nothing left. You have complete total muscle failure.
Right.
Because you can't say, okay, everybody, let's take a break now. You know, whatever. 200 people right there in front of you. All right, everybody, take a break. No, you got to go. So I think it was Michael. It had to be Michael, the director. When I couldn't climb the rope anymore to make it look smooth, he said, okay, Sam, just come down the rope and we'll roll the film in reverse. And I said, man, that's really cool. Let's do that. So it worked, you know.
Perhaps my favorite scene in Flash Gordon is the fight between Flash and Prince Baron, played by Dalton, on that rotating disc of death. Do you guys remember that? I mean, were you guys worried about Flash getting poked in the eye or anything like that?
Oh my gosh, my heart was a flutter.
It still is. I can hear it.
Well, Sam explained to me just exactly what happened during that fight and what would happen when they would fall off, because even though they don't fall off in the movie, they fell off quite a bit filming it. So what happens? What was down there? How far did they fall? Did they have to be flown back by a rocket sled? I don't know. He explained. Let's hear it a little bit.
Surrounding the disc at the bottom, instead of pads or airbags or big pieces of foam, the English used, which was kind of clever. At first I thought they were crazy, but they would stack gigantic boxes. They would offset the stacks. So I thought to myself, are you kidding me? If I fall, which I knew I was going to fall a lot because we had to operate on the edge of the disc. Every time it tilted, I knew we'd be falling off. And the stuntman said, trust me, Sam, we've been doing this for years. And sure enough, the first time I fell into the boxes, just for a split second, you thought, oh, it felt sharp, and then your body molded. Yeah, your body would mold into these pieces of cardboard boxes, and it worked out perfect. You know, we end up going through a lot of boxes that collapse, but still, it worked perfect.
Sam also shared his reaction to the final cut of the film when he first saw it, and it might not be exactly what you would expect.
You know, it's very hard for me to be objective. I've learned over the years to be objective, but I'm very difficult on myself, and I guess to summarize it in a nutshell, I was pretty proud of the work I did, considering what we had to deal with at the time, on a very, very fast pace. But to posture myself in an objective position, I sat to the first time watching it thinking, now, wait a minute, am I supposed to laugh at that, or are they being serious? Is it camp? You know, when you look at the special effects, you go, oh, that's kind of funny, but are they trying to be funny, or is that the best they could do as far as special effects? And then you realize, okay, you can sit there and you can actually dissect it, and you can brainstorm as much as you want, when in fact all the viewer has to do is just sit back and enjoy the ride. You know, really. I mean, visually, it's exceptional. It's beautiful with all the what we discussed before with the production quality and the costumes and the sets and all of that. So that's my recommendation for anybody. Just sit back and enjoy the ride and try not to conduct brain surgery on it, you know?
Well, that was the charm for me, because when I saw it as in the theater when I was 12 years old. And so I think I was the ideal age to really just soak it up and enjoy it for all that it was worth. Were you signed for sequels? Was there talk of sequels? Were there plans?
Yeah, I think if I'm not mistaken, there was a 6-picture deal, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure why. I know it didn't do – in America was the only country it didn't really exceed expectations. It really didn't do it was not a big box office smash in America, but in every other country it was. And finally, when it came out on VHS, it became top 10 of all time in America.
So one of the most exciting things perhaps to come out of Star Wars was you got lots and lots of toys. You had to wait a little bit for that first round, but now I think they kind of compensated for it.
We've got a few.
Yeah, Flash Gordon was not that story. And so if you can encapsulate in a little bit.
20 seconds
or 20 minutes.
No.
This is a very important thing for you, Jason, because you were super duper disappointed. Mm. And I'll kind of tell your story and then you tell me what you did, because you went to the store and you couldn't find anything. You're just like, where are the Flash Gordon action figures?
Uh-huh.
And you went ahead as a person who is in the industry of making toys.
Yeah. Well,
what did you do?
Well, to be fair, I mean, before I even kicked off Biff Bang Pow, I work in entertainment. I mean, I write and produce on stuff and I do voiceover and everything. So, but a lot of that wasn't year round, you know, it was jobbing, you know, jobbing actor, jobbing producer, whatever. I set up the toy company about 10 years ago, just, you know, thinking I could have a coffee shop that would earn while I was doing other stuff. And that's a whole other podcast.
All our toy companies that we did just for a side bar earning, they all closed within a week.
Well, that's one of the things.
We just took old Mego dolls and switched the heads on them.
Spray painted them. The kids all got sick. No, but there's been a lot of craziness with that. But the short list that I had was a series called Spaced with Simon Pegg and mm-hmm. Jessica Stevenson.
Mm-hmm.
She's now Hines, but Edgar Wright, The Big Lebowski, mm-hmm. and Flash Gordon on my short list. And it was a whole convoluted, crazy thing to get the rights, and no one knew where the rights were, and Universal and King Features. But we launched with a couple of characters, and it really harked back to that. The George Harrison thing about financing Life of Brian, and they finally said, why did you do it? And he said, I just wanted to see the film. You know?
Yeah.
And it was like that, well, no one's going to make this stuff. I'll give it a go. How hard could it be? but that's kind of how that kicked off. And then it did, all, you know, things did well. As soon as I saw Ted, I thought, we got to get back to this. Mm-hmm. And then the license now is much broader, many more items, and now it's 3¾
Yeah, the original ones were, what, six and seven
yeah,
inches?
Yeah, like a DC Direct, you know, Marvel Legends kind of
and
size.
And now it's all about, especially with reaction figures and everyone's love for the original Kenner and now Hasbro Star Wars action figures. So you're kind of in that neighborhood now. I can now play Star Wars meets Flash Gordon
in the tub.
Yeah.
Well, that's the idea. I mean, for me, the golden time of Star Wars was 77 to late 79, when we don't have all the answers, when it was Hammerhead and Snaggletooth. They didn't have last names. That's kind of what I want this line to be, if it works with play sets and everything else. But if you'll notice, we added a little bit of articulation, the knees and the elbows.
You cheated. That's
a
good thing.
Which is a radical thing to do for retro figures.
So these action figures are available now at what, Biff Bang Pow, Entertainment Earth. How do you get these things?
Your best bet probably is to go to entertainmentearth.com. Mm-hmm. They carry all the Biff Bang Pow products, not just Flash Gordon, but all the licenses, Twilight Zone, you know, Dexter, the Venture Brothers, everything. That's your best bet, I think. Or, you know, mom and pop places or websites, whoever's carrying it, please support them, because they're helping it. The more it's supported, the more we'll do. The more characters we can make. It's that simple, really. And Wave 2 is in the works right now.
Oh, excellent. Yes. I can't wait to see that.
Yes.
Well, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking a different topic, Space 1999.
Woo!
And we're going to be hearing from Oscar winner Martin Landau himself, which is very, very cool.
He's here too?
He is also under the table.
Oh, we keep everyone in the box, man.
Don't tell me Barbara Bain's here, because we had a thing.
Puts the lotion in the basket.
Are you troubled by strange noises in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread in your basement or attic?
Have you or any of your family ever seen a spook, specter, or ghost?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your phone and call the professionals. Go, Ghostbusters. Our courteous and efficient staff is on call 24 hours a day to serve all your supernatural elimination needs.
We're ready to believe you.
We're back. Who here, other than me, has seen and loves or likes or knows Space 1999?
Raise the hands. Everyone raising hands?
I'm raising my hand right now.
So I'm in a room that appreciates a show that I loved and loved.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So tell me your, I mean, 99 is something that you love.
Oh, yeah.
You don't just like it.
Oh,
you
yeah.
really love, because you're like Brian Hyler in that respect. Like, he's a mega fan. Of
yeah, the plaid stallions / pod stallions guy.
Yes, Brian my pal, my from a Canadian mother. So you love this thing. You don't just like it. So tell me why you love this.
Well,
what is it about?
Being the editor of the magazine, I can decide whether or not I want to put Space 1999 in our sci-fi and themed issue. And
right.
I loved it. Yeah. So I obviously did do that, and I really went the extra mile because, you know, when you're putting an issue together, you kind of try and find a theme. You try and find something to make a cohesive piece of literature.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than something that you line the hamster cage with.
By the way, that's a reference about print things. Do you know paper? Do you remember
that
paper?
What we do?
But can I just did you come to it before or after Star Trek? Like Star Trek syndication, you're a kid.
I was a huge Star Trek fan.
Okay.
And I watched Star Trek every single night.
Yeah.
And it was in syndication.
Right.
And so in my world, Star Trek and shows like that, they were just a daily event.
Mm-hmm.
And then Space 1999 came along in 75. I was 7 years old. And I was awestruck with the music. I mean, that opening theme was killer. Let's pause for a minute, and then let's listen to this wonderful theme just to give you guys an idea. So that music, like, gets me pumped every single – I could work out to that music every single time. And that was the season one theme, which actually changed – that was Barry Gray did the season one theme. And
That's
then it
right.
changed entirely to another theme, which is still pretty rockin'.
And Barry Gray, he had a history at that point with the Andersons.
Jerry Anderson, who produced Space 1999.
And Thunderbirds.
And UFO.
Captain Scar. I think Barry Gray did most of those themes.
Mm-hmm.
Joe 90, all that stuff was – he was a staple.
It's good stuff. And
so
for me, Space 1999 came along. I have to say that I probably just was flipping around on the channels and I saw this show and I was the prime age to just pretend that I was running around my own Moonbase Alpha. And I was also, maybe I'm just naive or uneducated or perhaps plain dumb, but I was confident.
Possibly.
I was confident they shot this on the moon. All those effects were so spectacular that Eagles, Space 19, Spiegel, Moonbase Alpha, all of that was so convincing. You can laugh out loud.
No,
you don't have to
because
hide your laughter.
I should probably say this for off air. Someday I'll tell you what Brian Hyler thought Star Trek was when he first saw it as a kid. He had basically thought it was like a documentary, that this was real shit going on. In real time, this was happening.
I believe that to be true. And,
yes.
And another quick aside, I also have to say maybe it was very – I must have missed that day at school because when I saw Star Wars, I guess because the moon landing was just – it was such a – it was a fact at that point. Mm-hmm. And in your mind – and when people were talking about the moon landing a lot by then, they're still just always talking about it. Mm-hmm. You think that, well, they must go to the moon all the time. There must be someone on the moon right now.
It's why Sunday. They're on the moon.
Yeah, why is there not a moon-based Alpha? You know, the space shuttle when it launched – it became so commonplace they had to do some things to make people interested in it again. So
I think there's a Walmart up there.
When I saw Star Wars, I was savvy enough to filmmaking that I was like, all right, so I know that they weren't having, you know, dogfights in space. Clearly, Lucas was up there and said, okay, X-Wing's over here, TIE Fighter's over here, right. And action. And they'd have a dogfight, and they'd say, cut, cut, cut. All right, everyone back to back. One.
Unnatural. I mean, but they shot that in space, right? Unnatural. But, I mean, you know, you didn't – you know, we took some of that stuff in. We were still figuring stuff out. Like, what – are those actors?
Am I alone in thinking this, or is anyone else on my team when it comes to thinking things were shot in space when you saw
– Beauty and the Beast?
Yeah, right.
Or beaches.
Right?
Pocahontas was a live stream.
When I first saw Star Trek and a little bit of Star Wars, I thought to myself, how come I don't see these ships they're filming outside? It should have happened. It's a big ship. How do you miss that?
See?
Vindication. The Enterprise is stored in the parking lot in Detroit or something.
I think it was Jurassic Park for me. I thought, like, the dinosaurs were real. I was like, oh, I love them so much, but now that they're here, I don't think I want – I don't like them anymore.
That's a great story, but can I jump in and go, so Jason, what was the moment that you felt about 75 during the podcast? When he talked about Jurassic Park as a child and what it meant to him? Yeah, that was the moment that put me over the edge. What about you?
I mean, you know, we watched the first episode this morning, and I still feel like the graphics hold up.
Oh, yeah.
I don't.
So those are models. Those are all models.
The effects work does hold up.
Entirely models.
Pretty well, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, wasn't it a massive budget for the time, like one of the biggest.
It was the biggest budget show in the 70s for a TV.
Yeah,
exactly.
Like and blew my mind.
Oh yeah, the effects guys from 2001: Space Odyssey, which this show drew a lot of inspiration from. They were the people who put this together, so it was super convincing. So
and keep in mind,
Caroline, you're saying this still holds up to this day.
Yeah. No, I thought it looked pretty spectacular. I don't think I would go as far to say I thought they were filming on the moon.
Well, no. I hope
no one's that dumb. Come on, no, but I'm saying, but that's how convincing the model work is. But to be fair, again, back to how great the show is and how well it's crafted.
Yeah.
People forget what you just said. 2001, so 99 crew, Battlestar Galactica, the original show, Dykstra and that crew, they were doing widescreen effects for the small screen.
Right.
That was the thing. Like they were doing effect shots that normally would have been, and it was compromised. And remember, like, you know, when I was over at the hotel in London, one day I'm flipping around and all of a sudden there's Doctor Who, the Tom Baker Doctor Who, on television. Mm. And it's huge. And my wife at one point went, I can literally smell the paint drying on that floor of the thing. And I said, it wasn't made for that kind of viewer. It was made for this. Mm. But if you do watch 99 on that kind of a massive screen, it's gorgeous. But amazing.
I have to sort of explain why I love Space 1999 so much. I was already a huge Star Trek fan. Mm-hmm. I was Captain Kirk. I ran around and I played outside and I played inside. And
Have the Remco utility belt?
Of course. I'm wearing it right now. And I loved Star Trek so much that I remember my sister had something over me and I had something over my sister and she said, all right, fine, whatever you want to do, just as long as you do X, Y, or Z for me. And I said, all right, we're going to play Star Trek and you're going to be Spock. And she's like, oh, fine.
That showed her. You know, I didn't have the utility belt, but I did have the Shatner girdle when I was a kid. I wore that to school every day, and no one messed with me. No one ever fucked with me with that thing. I'm telling you right now. But wait, you just said something about see, I liked it. I didn't love it. Star Trek I loved as a kid, but do you find 99 was it, and I don't know this because you're the expert, like, was it supposed to be a bit of a antithesis to a lot of the, you know, romance and punching of Kirk and that?
Well, it was meant to be an intellectual show with action. I mean, for those who don't know the concept of Space 1999, it takes place in, wait, I can't remember what year.
97?
September 15th.
98? Somewhere
2000.
Somewhere in the late 90s.
And there's a moon base, Alpha, is on the moon, and what the Earth is doing is all their radioactive waste is being stored on the far side of the moon.
Why don't we do
this? So this is timely. This is very timely. Well, we could put ISIS there first, right, and then we'll do the other stuff.
I don't think she'd like it, though. You bunch of nerds.
I watched the Shazam ISIS show, but we digress. And so basically the concept is there's such a huge stockpile, and what happens is it explodes. There's a giant nuclear explosion, and the moon is shot out of its orbit, and it's got a trajectory straight out of the solar system. And the concept was very much like Star Trek in that each – episode, it's a, there's no through line other than the fact that they want to find a home. But the thing is, every episode, the moon is flying through a new solar system. They want to find a place to live, and they encounter some sort of conflict and friction and so on. And
Stargate.
Oh, yeah.
Can I just – okay, first question is, and nerd alert, was that opening or that premise ripped off for Thundar the Barbarian? Wasn't it? No, I'm serious. Wasn't it that the moon went out of orbit?
Well, they had a broken moon or something like that.
Yeah, and caused all kinds of chaos or something, but wasn't it something out of orbit? And number two, that still doesn't explain why they put hinges on the windows on the moon base.
Wait a minute.
Why would they put hinges?
And why did Commander Koenig have a sun sword? That's my question. So this is
now,
before,
were he and Bane this, characters? Were they romantic
well,
on the show?
Yeah, well, no. Yes, they were romantic on the show. Barbara Bane was Martin Landau's wife. Martin Landau was a big star already, and when they were putting this show together, they said the only way we could do this is it was actually meant to be – Gerry Anderson was putting together a follow-up season after the first season of his show UFO, which has amazing effects in and of itself. And they just said it's too expensive. We're not going to be doing it, but we can – Gerry Anderson had already done so much work on it. He said, why don't we take this work and we will rework it to make it an entirely different show. And what we'll do is, because we've spent so much of your money already on our second season, we'll turn it into a new show. And they said, we'll do that if you can get an American lead, because they were shooting this in the UK in the 70s. And Barbara Bain and Martin Landau were already co-stars on Mission Impossible. This is a TV show that was before Tom Cruise was in a bunch of movies.
Yeah. What?
Yes.
And so,
I'm so confused.
And so they were a package deal, at least not necessarily according to him. Martin Landau told me that they didn't see themselves as a package deal. But when they were when he was pitched as being the commander of this of Moonbase Alpha, he said, well, I'm going to be living in London. I'm going to have to bring my whole family over there. There's a role here for a formidable role for a woman as the chief medical officer. And why not Barbara Bain?
Right.
And so it was kind of sold as a package deal. And they came over there and they immediately started finding a little bit of friction with the producers
and
about – how they wanted to kind of simplify it. Well, they wanted to simply – the producers wanted very long story short, and you can read a lot more of this, about the details of the struggles in
– on newsstands now.
Famous Monsters Magazine.
Or at CaptainCo.com.
But the nutshell version is there were a lot of fights behind the scenes in terms of simplification versus keeping it an intelligent story.
Okay, then let me ask you this, because this is a name that I heard that's associated with the show. So Star Trek – first season or two was supposed to be a very highbrow, you know, intellectual thing.
Third season.
Fred
Freiberger.
Freiberger comes in third season and becomes Bug-Eyed Monsters. Wasn't he a producer on
– He was the producer.
Did he become
– Well, Space 1999 had two seasons.
Okay.
Season one was the intellectual season. Mm-hmm. Season two was the action-packed season with the Bug-Eyed Monsters.
Which
literally
was Freiberger?
Literally, and that was Freiberger. Yeah.
So, but my question then is, if he comes in third season of Star Trek and it kills the show
– right.
Why bring him into second season?
He wasn't necessarily known for killing. Well, he was only later, in retrospect, known as a show killer to some.
What's another show then?
I'm hard pressed right
that
off
one?
The top of my head.
Love
but,
Boat?
But, well,
Love Boat?
It was Fantasy Island.
Fantasy Island.
But
I thought that the Freiberger.
All I could say is Martin Landau was not keen on Mr. Freiberger. They had their disagreements, and Martin Landau really loved that first season, and they were going to do a third season as well. And the thing is, the second season kind of became a monster of the week show. I mean, they brought in Catherine Schell,
right,
who was a shape-changing metamorph. And literally, they'd say, oh, wait, something bad is happening. We need to get on the other side. Quick, change. And she'd become a bug and climb through a little vent. Or
not
there'd
bad
be
power.
Someone out of control. And they would they'd say, Maya, we need your help. And she'd become this, like, insane alien monster.
And was Christopher Lee in the first or second season?
Well, that's
season?
The thing is, you know, there were all these amazing guest stars throughout the entire show. Brian Blessed played Catherine Schell's Maya's dad.
Oh,
and he's in there.
Speaking of Matt Berry, who you know from the Boosh, just filmed the week before with Brian Blessed. Blessed's playing his father on Toast.
That's like perfect casting.
Right? It's right there, yeah.
Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing, Joan Collins, Ian McShane, Sarah Douglas.
Oh my gosh.
Julian
Well, yeah, there were some Star Wars people, too. Yeah. Julian Glover was there. David Prowse, a.k.a. Darth Vader.
Yes.
So it's a show that it's a little creaky with age, but it's very cool to watch, and it's very fun to watch. And if anything, the effects put a lot of contemporary shows to shame, and it's very cool because you know that these things are actually happening on the moon.
In real time. Did you know who Sylvia Anderson wanted for the lead? I just discovered this through Hyler. Do you
know
this?
Yes, yes. Well, it's in, you know what?
Oh, is it in the, that's maybe where I read it.
You read it in Famous Monsters.
Listen what I just discovered all on my own.
Did Brian Hyler write the article? I'm not quite sure.
Wait, who are you talking about? Would remind me, because I read everything. Robert, so what was?
Robert Culp.
Robert Culp.
That's right.
Yes, and I thought there was a confusion. Maybe it was Robert Vaughn, but it wasn't Vaughn because he worked with the Andersons on The Champions.
Wait, no, it was Robert Vaughn.
Okay, he says
it's too many Roberts. He says Culp and a Vaughn.
The reason it wasn't Vaughn, he says, is that the Andersons couldn't stand Robert Vaughn because they'd worked with him. Culp, who anybody know, Greatest American Hero, the FBI guy. He would have been the lead, which in my brain just goes, that would have been like an acid trip.
Speaking of lead,
he was such a hippie.
Martin Landau was supposed to originally, he was the original choice by Gene Roddenberry to play Spock.
Yep.
And in my conversation with Martin Landau, it was a wonderful thing. He talked about that. He talked about Space 1999. And when I originally thought, because I'm the executive editor of Famous Monsters and I love Space 1999, Jason, that was my opportunity to say, you know what? Let's capitalize on this. And I'm going to see if I can – I mean, it's pie in the sky for me because it's Martin Landau, Oscar winner.
Right.
You know, Crimes and Misdemeanors, Ed Wood, all that stuff like that. Mm-hmm. He's just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And I asked I asked for an hour. And they graciously said, yes, you can have an hour with Martin Landau. Mm. And so I went and I sat down with him at a boardroom. And it was an incredible experience because not only did I get an hour with him, just the two of us chit-chatting about Space 1999, Ed Wood, and his entire career, he just loved to talk. And he loved talking to me. And, and we talked.
Who doesn't, David? Well, come on.
Like this podcast, it went for 4.5 hours.
No, it didn't.
You think I'm exaggerating about that, but I literally
did
sat
it really?
With Martin Landau for 4 hours.
And you
four
got
and
you,
hours.
You did get to Crimes and Misdemeanors, didn't you?
Oh, it was like a one-man show. He did impressions of everybody from Hitchcock to Woody Allen to...
Listen, beyond all the gold I've already delivered to you people and the listeners, if you're keen or curious at all about Martin Landau beyond Space 1990, please run, don't walk, to the Woody Allen film Crimes and Misdemeanors. It is the single greatest thing he's ever done. One of the greatest acting, well, probably one of the greatest roles Woody Allen's ever written, and it is an extraordinary movie if you haven't seen it, but that's all.
So I had an opportunity to talk with Mr. Landau, and it was a wonderful conversation, and he's a wonderful person. He really enjoys telling stories, and he said, my apologies, I'm hitting another tangent, and I said, as long as you want to get tangents all day long, I will be happy to listen. And he took me up on that. I kid you not, it was 4.5 hours.
It's actually a good name for a band.
He would have kept on going if I didn't have to like get across town to get home and
can I ask you this?
Go to the bathroom.
Whether you pose this or not, and you know, because I remember Tim Burton or someone was talking about the time of Ed Wood, how they felt that Landau could kind of relate to Lugosi and what he went through, because here was a guy that was from the Actors Studio, worked with Hitchcock, etc., mega international star on these shows. By late 70s is doing, you know, the Gilligan's Island TV movies.
He's with Cleopatra. He's with Burton, Burton and Taylor.
Yeah.
And he was pals with James Dean, and then he's on Gilligan's Island.
Did he ever sort of talk about that? Was it for him just, I was always working, or did he say, yeah, there was a period there that, because it wasn't really until, like, Tucker and Crimes and Misdemeanors that the needle started to kind of go back.
He was happy. He has perspective.
Okay.
And he knows about maintaining longevity, and he knows that in a career you have highs and lows, and when you have a low, you don't bail.
Mm-hmm.
And so he stayed the course, and he just took the work when it came. Yeah. He was as selective as he could be, but he was also he's got tremendous common sense.
Sure.
And his recollection of names, dates, locations puts me to shame. Yeah. It's everyone's a shame. It's amazing.
Did he have recall for the casting? Skippy. Did he have recall about the Spock thing?
Yeah. He talked about. Well, he said he and Lenny were buddies because they were working at Paramount.
Nice.
And they had sound stages next to each other, and they were buddies. And there was that exchange because he was supposed to be on Star Trek, but chose not to because he did not want to play an unemotional character.
Right.
But when he left Mission Impossible, that's when Leonard Nimoy came on the show.
That's
to
right.
fill the void that he left when he and Barbara Bain went over to do Space.
Oh,
Nine.
That's a trip. I forgot about that. Yeah. Do you know who they wanted for Kirk at the time in the original Star Trek?
Jason Lindsay.
Brian Blessed. No, that's not true. That's not true at all.
Well, I want to play with our limited time. I want to get a little
if you
bit
could
of
just
Martin Landau.
Stop talking,
in
you people.
So we're
and
now
let me get a word in.
If
once
you
in a
guys
while.
would listen, we're going to now play the unedited 4.5 version of my conversation with Martin Landau. Wouldn't that be nice? No. Okay. So we're going to play a couple clips.
This was, you know, before Star Wars, and I always felt that with science fiction, you could say things that you couldn't say in contemporary context. And I was always conscious of stuff. And I said, wow, this is a great idea. We could draw parallels with, you know, the Israelis, the Arabs, the Irish blowing each other up, I mean, all kinds of stuff. I said, you know, you can be Henry Kissinger on a series and touch things. I think a third season would have been different again. I think, you know, I think the Andersons, Jerry and Lou, would have made more money out of, you know, the third season would have given them a better syndication package.
If you could have changed something.
I'd go back to the first season.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a much more philosophical show with more patience. It didn't need, you know, the thing that was important in the first season when we were searching for a place to live, a planet that was compatible with our needs in passing planets. Is that a good one? Is that one that can help us? And that was lost in the second season. I mean, the whole idea of the first season was if we wanted to do what we were doing, we couldn't have done it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was circumstance of fate that knocked us out of orbit. And here we are, pioneers, hurtling through space at a ridiculous amount of speed, passing planets. Can we breathe here? Can we live here? Can we eat here? Is there other animal life there? I mean, all of that stuff, which is not spoken about all the time, but is very present in my mind as commander. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the responsibility of having 300 people, children, my kids, there's 300 people who can't procreate until we find that planet. But somewhere out here in the darkness, we're going to come to one and we're equipped to leave this moon, which, in my mind's eye, was always a temporary place.
Right.
It was basically a spaceship with other spaceships that we could actually steer. That responsibility, you know, I was very aware of what Koenig had to do in the first season. The second season, a lot of that was forfeited because Freddie had ridiculous storylines. Mm. I mean, with Catherine turning into God knows what, you know, leopards and sometimes ridiculous things that were not made well. I mean, a bunch of rubber monsters, you should forgive the expression, that, you know, I'd say, God.
Oh, that was great.
it's amazing, you know. Tangent.
You sound just like him.
I do.
Yeah. Oh wait, maybe that was him.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, sorry.
There's a one man show going on in here, and I don't think it's Martin Landau. So one of the coolest things
that is the opening of the show. Put that in the quote on the website.
One of the coolest things about now you love toys. I love toys.
I do.
We all love toys that are.
I love toys.
Merchandising for Space 1999 was insane. It was there were dinky toys.
Yes.
And then when I say dinky, that's a brand name as opposed to they were kind of dinky.
They were, but they were also kind of dinky.
They had Eagles. Yeah. They had Rack toys. They had everything in between. Mm-hmm. And for me, there was a small. There was a Moonbase Alpha that had action figures. Mm-hmm. You could have your own little Moonbase Alpha. The dolls were just not quite up to snuff. Then this is before Star Wars, but all you had to compare everything was to the Mego toys.
Yeah.
The one, you know, whether it was Planet of the Apes or Star Trek or our superheroes, the Migos had more articulation. I mean, their hands
still phenomenal.
But there is some kind of a divide between Palitoy, which was essentially Mego in the UK, mm-hmm. and Mattel in the US doing. So the Mattel ones are more. Stiff-armed and legs.
Right. It's what, 5 points of articulation, which it was a true pleasure to have Martin Landau imitate his own doll by doing the 5 points of articulation dance.
It's
doing the robot.
I have mentioned that to Brian Hyler, who's a mega, as Indiana Jones would say, he should be, you know, Abner's the real expert, Abner Ravenwood. Like, I know about 99, but he... and the merchandise, but there was an issue with likenesses as well. There was something to do with, and you know, a lot of times, you know, when that stuff happens way back, and then 30 years later, Barbara Bain might go, "Hey, what the hell?" You know, they don't really know the deal that they signed. I mean, it was a different world. You didn't think that this stuff was going to be out there forever necessarily.
You sign your soul away,
kind of. Yeah, sometimes, and there was something to do with. Overseas versus here, or something on the rack stuff, maybe too. I don't know.
They had the better toys, so it's funny, Lando. Yeah. He pointed out that he said, well, it kind of looked like me. And he also talked about how his granddaughter now plays with it. And he's like, I had a couple of them, but wait a minute, somebody swiped it. But I have to say that the piece de resistance for me was this Mattel Eagle that they had that was about, it was almost 3 feet long. This thing was giant.
Massive.
And the front head piece of the Eagle transporter came off, and the back afterburners came off, and you could click those together to have your own sort of satellite spaceship flying around. And this thing was giant, and it was an amazing playset that you could just.
And it came with two figures?
It came with three figures,
Landau,
but they were not very articulated as well. But they were in their spacesuits.
Who was the other? It was Barry.
Barry Morris.
Was
Barbara
he in season
Main.
Two?
He was only in season one.
Only in season one.
Unfortunately, he moved.
And he
on.
Was like the McCoy.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
The doctor.
He was sort of the conscience of.
Also in the Fugitive TV series, which was a TV show before it was a movie. Anybody remember the movie? That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
Is this another old people thing?
Yes. We're showing it at the home later on tonight. Sorry.
Well,
I'm not that old, okay? Jesus.
The new issue of Famous Monsters is packed with a lot of great stuff from this.
Can I just say it's my favorite? I don't mean to be biased, but it is my favorite Famous Monsters issue
of all
time.
Oh, you've read it? Yeah. Are you saying that because you're in it?
Probably because I'm in it, but could just be the content. I don't know.
Well, there's amazing content in there. Do you remember what some of the content is?
Of course I
do. Do you want to plug some of the content for me?
Well, a little film from 1980 called Flash Gordon, Space 1999.
Never heard of it.
The Shining.
Uh-huh.
Me.
What's the Shining thing?
The Shining is the two. What were they? Fidgets?
The
were they
Grady
kids or
sisters.
Were they? No, were they the sisters?
Yeah, the Grady sisters, Lisa and Louise.
Didn't
Burns.
Didn't Fonzie date them? Or was that the Lumbreenses?
That was Pinky Tuscadero.
Pinky Tuscadero. They're in it. Star Wars before and now.
Yeah.
Mark Hamill, you got the bombshell.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like. Charlie Sheen's announcement the other day. That was a big deal. No, but that was, I mean, that thing then went, that was the most he had sort of said about his involvement.
Yeah, he was sort of in hiding up until that point. I mean, he's kind of everywhere now, now that the movie is on the verge of coming out.
Yeah, that was a
coup. The Force Awakens.
That was very cool.
Well, that was very cool. That was very cool.
It's a great issue. It's my favorite of all time.
Well, he's a super monster kid, and he loves all these, everything Famous Monsters related.
Can I just ask?
We were all super excited about that. There were many of us lined up outside the door, sort of listening in on that interview.
He was on speakerphone.
He was under the table.
Okay.
It's just one of those moments where you're like, wait, I recognize that foot. Is he talking to Mark Hamill?
Yeah, half of me was like Star Wars, and the other half was like, it's the Joker, it's the Joker, it's the Joker.
Wow. Am I allowed to ask an FM-related question while
we're
here? Where does the term monster kid, like, where did that come from? FM?
Oh, well, that's a whole long tale.
But have you got
the nutshell version is that in the late 50s, all the movies, like the classic Universal movies,
right,
the monster movies, Dracula, Frankenstein,
right, they all
were syndicated in this big package around the nation, where everyone was encouraged to have their own horror host in each city. And it took off again
So
a whole new generation that wasn't privy to seeing these movies in the theater now got to see them on the TV all the time, whether it was a midnight movie or a Saturday matinee. And so a whole merchandising craze tied into that, and Famous Monsters magazine tied into that, and
so is that
fueled
like late 50s?
At the same time. Late early 50s 60s? Through 60s was the boom.
Okay.
Big boom. And that's when Mark Hamill picked up his first copy. It was in 62.
But when you say Monster Kid, I know exactly what you mean, what you're referring to, and Hamill, but it's not just that generation, right? I mean, a Monster Kid, I mean, Caroline, you're a Monster Kid.
Well,
right?
I think,
or is that specifically that period and that generation? You can talk about?
Well, there is, unless you're looking at Wikipedia, there is no thing carved into a piece of slate that says what a Monster Kid is.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. Like,
there's a Monster Kid from every era.
That being said, I think one of the mission statements of Famous Monsters magazine in our current day and age is to inspire people to understand what it's all about.
Yeah, the gospel.
And
so we're all monster kids.
Absolutely.
You know? And even if we might not call ourselves that, even if we're geeks or nerds or enthusiasts about stuff, I think if you're really into a broad range of horror monsters, rubber monsters to CGI monsters, you're still a CGI you're a CGI kid. You're a monster kid.
Am I a CGI kid?
By the way, you've been talking to a hologram this entire time.
Yeah, that's. I thought it was the generational thing, but I just wasn't sure if it was in use today. Sort of.
So we're going to wrap things up, and we want to thank Jason Lindsay for. Is it Lindsay or Lindsay?
It's Lindsay. Lindsay.
Yeah. Jason Lindsay.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much.
We really appreciate you having. I'm so speechless.
Take two.
Having you here,
guys. I cannot thank you enough for having me here and the invite, and David, everything that you and the magazine have done for me personally, just that kind of exposure in the magazine and Biff Bang Pow and everything else, and it's just it is beyond flattering. So thanks for having me, and I'll come back anytime should you wish me to. If the ratings go through the roof, I hope you have me back.
So who rubbed the lamp? You'll appear?
Yeah.
We're changing the locks after he leaves.
Yes, exactly. So Jason is in the magazine with his pal Alex Ross, comic book artist, who did a wonderful piece of art for the 35th anniversary that you could see in our magazine.
Yes, can I just say?
It is so epic.
Yeah. So the print premiered at BAFTA on the night, but it will soon, in the new year, be available for everybody else. But you won't have it signed by everyone like I do. But you will have it signed by Alex Ross, should you wish to pay for it.
Caroline, where can people get this wonderful issue?
So the issue is available on CaptainCo.com as well as your local Barnes & Noble. But big announcement, we are now going digital.
Yay! Sorry, what is this digital thing you speak of?
Well, old man. yes, all the issues are from now going forward are going to be available online at Magzter. That's MAGZTER. Available for purchase. Does anyone know the actual price they're going to be online? That is something.
Go to Magster and find out. I think we're working it out right now.
Ooh, it's a
but
surprise.
It's available. It's available on Magster now. But it's so new, I can smell the paint.
Nice.
So the new issue, whether you get it on Magster or Barnes & Noble or newsstands or FamousMonsters.com or Captain Co., it's packed with great stuff like we were talking about. Plus, Krampus director Michael Dougherty and one of the stars of the movie, David Koechner, are in there. The Walking Dead's Greg Nicotero talking about the season to come and the season that we just had that was pretty intense. Even Simpsons character designer Eric Keyes, he's our resident cartoonist. He's got some stuff in there, and he did some wonderful stuff in the last issue as well, which was his first issue. You got to seek it out. We got to seek it out. And, for those who might not know, we're just going to mention real quickly that Famous Monsters also does comics. Cameron, do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, you can find out more information at AmericanGothicPress.com. We have several titles available at the website there and also on CaptainCo.com. And for those of you interested, yes, we are going to have an American Gothic Press podcast in the new year.
Ooh, golf clap. Golf clap.
Hosted by yours truly. So if you want more of my annoying voice, congratulations. We've got something just in store for you.
There we go. Hey, what's your favorite of the new stuff that we're putting out right now? Give me a title or two. What's your favorite?
I mean, just Broken Moon has been fantastic. Mm. Monster World's pretty epic. Werewolves. And then Project Nemesis, like Jeremy Robinson and Matt Frank, are just killing it.
Caroline, Werewolves. You like Werewolves?
I like Werewolves? What?
Oh, I have a scoop I can give you.
Oh, okay.
Exclusively, but you tell me why you love werewolves. First.
Wait, that's another podcast. Podcast entirely.
You don't have enough life.
You don't.
Is everyone up to date on Penny Dreadful? Has anyone watched it? Oh. Never mind then. Maybe I shouldn't. I'll just tell David in private. Sorry.
All right, George.
I shouldn't. I thought better of it. Never mind.
That's all right.
Sorry. Sorry, everyone. Sorry. Get carried away.
George, what's your favorite out there right now? And by the way, you could be biased as well. While Jason is in Famous Monsters, George, you have a cover, a variant cover? Wait a minute.
What?
Remember
what?
We said you're jack of all trades and trains.
You're drunk. Are you drunk?
I think I am.
You've been
drunk.
What's in that thing?
I'm just hungry.
You are drunk.
Is that Arrowhead bottle?
So wait, what's your story? You've got a quick connection and then we'll move on.
I currently did our local comic shop day, Project Nemesis number 2 cover.
Nice.
Super rare limited edition.
Yes, yes.
What's the local comic shop?
It was a special event that they just started doing this year. It's like Free Comic Book Day, but instead of getting free comic books, you pay for these variant covers.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, they're very beautifully done by many different comic books like Marvel and DC, and we had the pleasure in joining them.
Awesome. What was the shop? The exclusive? Sorry. For all comic shops or an exclusive?
It was a select comic shops across the board.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
And while we're plugging a bunch of things, it's the holiday season, and you could and should go to CaptainCo.com to get all sorts of stuff. Caroline,
we have tons of cool holiday merchandise this year, a bunch of new ugly sweater designs. We've got a lot of great sales going on. We also have up for sale our December shock box.
Oh, the shock box.
What is that? I hate to ask.
So that is our mystery box full of goodies, perfect for any sci-fi lovers, horror lovers, fantasy lovers.
It's a subscription.
If you're a fan of Loot Crate, what are some comparable boxes?
Oh, right.
Block, Box of Dread.
It's a blind box, and it's got lots of very Famous Monsters centric goodies in there. Can we reveal anything from the December box? And if not, what can we say was in previous boxes?
November box had the 1975 Famous Monsters convention poster printed on a T-shirt, which you can't get anywhere.
I was just going to ask about that because you guys are wearing it. It's awesome. You can subscribe like every month. You get a different.
Well, we don't have
boxes.
Subscriptions yet. Those are coming ASAP. Should be available right now. It is just month to month, but subscriptions coming ASAP.
Yeah, you go to Captain Co. Okay. And you get it, and you open the box, and there's lots of cool stuff and exclusive stuff. And you get a T-shirt, exclusive T-shirt in every box.
There's been a limited print we've been putting in every box that's done by Rick Baker, and it's a collector's set. At that.
No, come on.
It's a mad prank.
Wow. Any Victorian era pornography in these boxes?
That was
one out of every 50.
Oh, good. All right. Then I will sign up. Okay.
Very cool. So you can get your shock box. Go ahead, Caroline.
At CaptainCo.com. Also, we have running for a limited time. We have $29.99 subscriptions, which I think are the perfect gift for the holiday season. I'm getting one for my nephew, and I'm super excited to share the FM gospel.
Yeah,
with
that's
him.
Insane.
That's
insane.
A great. Wait, $29.99 for six.
For six issues.
That's really good. That's
but
a really
only
good price.
For a
regular
very limited
newsstand
time.
Price is about $2,000 a year.
It is. I know. That's awesome.
And so, anyway, we really appreciate you hanging out with us on this cut podcast. This is
Get back in your box.
Yeah, no, back in your box.
Back on the table.
It gets back in its box.
More, please.
And coming up on our next podcast, I'm going to be speaking with X-Files creator Chris Carter, who gives me a preview of the new X-Files miniseries coming to Fox in January.
You've seen some of it, haven't you?
I saw the whole the first episode. Yeah. I saw.
What?
Cool. Thumbs up.
I could tell you, but I will have to kill you all.
No details.
By alien abduction.
You're a fan, though, right?
I love that. And you know what? It's
It's better than
I will tell you, you get a good taste of it when you read Famous Monsters, because my interview with Chris Carter is in the magazine right now, previewing the January return.
This current issue. On
newsstands
now.
Exactly. And so, but the thing is, I have to tell you that when I saw that, I felt the old tingles. I felt the vibe. One of the cool things about, you know, it's nice because it's got contemporary effects. It's not... It feels crisp and it feels new, but it also feels exactly the same. And one of the nice little touches is that the original opening sequence, the opening theme, everything, the music is the same, and the footage is the same. It's exactly the same.
Oh my
Nothing
gosh.
Has changed.
Really?
So and excited. I talked to Chris Carter about that, and he explains his thought process behind not changing a thing.
Do they acknowledge the second film or just ignore it completely? The best thing about the film was Billy Connolly. It's in the film.
Great.
But other than that, it's like, what the? That was like a TV movie.
Yeah, it's all right. Well, it's one of those things where...
You know, I love kids. I don't know about this part in the film, but I love him.
We'd like to welcome Billy Connolly to the podcast.
Oh, it's great. I love having a wonderful time. It's great. I love it.
And on that note, we want to say thank you to everybody. We've got to throw out some Twitter handles. Jason, what's your Twitter handle?
I have no idea. No, I think it's at BBP Lenzi.
That's right, as in Biff Bang Pow Lenzi.
Right?
Why do I know your Twitter handle?
Because, you know what?
You?
No one's ever asked me. Do I say at when someone asks me, or do I just say BBP?
Wait, don't trip. Len-
the kids say at?
Yes. Do you say at? Okay.
Don't trip try on your walker say, right. on the way out.
Take
okay.
two. Hit me again.
All right. Well, no, we're not going to hit you.
No,
again.
Ask me again. I'll do this the right way. What's my Twitter address? It's BBP Lenzi.
Still forgot the app.
Shit. Sorry. At BBP Lenzi.
Cameron, do you have a Twitter handle?
I'm at Cam Comic Corner, and then I'm also in charge of the American Gothic Press Twitter account at AGP Monsters.
I am at Tiki Ambassador, and again, one day maybe I'll explain that. And how about the Famous Monsters Tiki? Oh my gosh, I am hungry and tired. The famous monsters handles.
You're not beyond you are drunk.
Beyond Twitter.
How many fingers am I holding?
Go
up
home, David.
Right
you're
now,
drunk.
You are. I mean, I didn't want to say it
I
in the first part of the show.
Well. I have
but
a
now
4-year-old
you're just
toddler.
Clearly an alcoholic because I don't know what you're.
Well,
saying.
You can find Famous Monsters on Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, Tumblr, YouTube,
MySpace?
Twitter at FMOF. No,
Jason's MySpace is what. Okay.
Listen, I can barely send attachments, okay? So shut up.
So, everyone out there, if you really like this, please spread the good word. And if you have iTunes and you're getting it on iTunes, we would greatly appreciate it. I'm trying not to laugh now. I don't know. We would greatly appreciate it. This is where my hat is in hand because we think it's a great podcast. You might have a different thought after this one. But
wow, he's looking right at me when he said that. What the hell?
But you know, put in a good word, a good comment, spread the word. If you enjoy Famous Monsters magazine, if you like our comics, please spread the word to your friends and your family and the people that you just meet on the street. And make sure to incorporate horror, sci-fi, fantasy, and genre pop culture.
You did say
into
your
conversations
horror.
To ensure generations of monster kids to come. And until next time, let's be careful out there.
Ooh. Thanks, everybody.
The Famous Monsters podcast is copyright Famous Monsters and Movieland Classics, LLC. All rights reserved.